Southampton.
Okay, so this is a map of disturbances in the United States in 1970. Okay, very widespread. And the interesting thing about it is that these places were hundreds of miles apart. Okay, hundreds of miles, 3,000 miles from one side to the other. And the leadership, even if there was a central organization, it would be very difficult to organize such a widespread thing. And my conviction is that the SDS and the Weathermen were small organizations, and in fact they sort of split before the major disturbances took place. And really, there were politicos on the campus, all sorts of people, I'll tell you about that. But it was locally organized. Okay, it was a sort of political genius that came out of the woodwork. See, that's St. Louis, that's where I was. See, it's probably 100 miles from there today, a couple of hundred miles, okay? A long way away. Okay, 300 miles to Chicago. So it was really up in the sticks. So that's the first thing to say about it. And I'm not going to discuss the virtues of or what it means, or the legacy of student revolutions. I mean, it's easy to discount student revolutions, you know, a romantic revolutionary for 3 years, and then you go and work for the oil company, you know. So I'm not going to get into that. Some didn't, you know. And I think, for instance, the Black Panthers started in Oakland College, you know. So much more interesting is the cultural revolution that took place in these people's minds. And just from the point of view, not necessarily that it lasted, but that it's possible, okay? So a whole section of the most privileged in the richest country of the world, and starting in the Ivy League colleges, you know, went through a kind of conversion process. And they were radicalized. And the American students in the 1960s had grown up with the American dream, you know. Their country always fought for good causes. They repeated the Pledge of Allegiance every morning at school, you know. And then, I'll read you the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. You know, well, apart from the God, that's a pretty good, you know, statement, isn't it? So they grew up with that and believing it. And really, the war opened their eyes. And the draft, it was the draft that projected them into rebellion. Okay? That's what I think. And obviously it's quite clear that the American occupation of Vietnam was defeated by the Vietnamese, you know. And they suffered mass deaths, you know. But I think the student revolution, the student rebellion, contributed to this, okay? Now, I arrived in late 67 to work in a lab for 3 years on an exchange visitor visa. I finished the thesis and then I went to America to get some experience. And I had a hell of a lot to learn, and I had a wife and a small child, and so I spent really the first year I was beavering away in the lab and not really conscious of anything else, you know. And in the second year, things took off. The actual movement took off on the campus where I was. I was here, where the arrow is. St. Louis, okay? So, right out in the city. And it was an elite college. It was supposed to be the Harvard of the Midwest, you know. The people who taught there couldn't afford to send their kids there, you know. So it was an elite college. And the students decided, I think this was probably decided through a sort of grapevine of the SDS and so on, but the way to oppose the war was trying to hamper directly the war effort. And the way they were going to do that was to agitate about and get and destroy the Reserve Officer Training Corps. On each campus there was a Reserve Officer Training Corps. And if you went into that, then you could go, in the draft, you could go as a junior officer. And the Americans relied on the Reserve Officer Training Corps to supply them with junior officers. It was quite a central place to attack the war. And so the slogan was, off Roxy, you know, it was called Roxy. And that was what the, so they had a direct handle, okay. Now, at the height of it, there were demonstrations on 1,300 campuses. Over 500 campuses were shut down. And 51 were shut down for the rest of the semester, you know. And Governor Reagan closed the state university system in California. You know, this is in 1970. So it was a really effective kind of locally organized rebellion. And of course, you know, at Kent State, four students were shot. And what people aren't conscious of very much is that at Jackson State, which is and Kent State is a state university in Ohio, in northern United States, in Mississippi, Jackson State, there were two students who were killed as well. So there had been precursors. There was a civil rights movement, students going down south for the voter registration. Earlier there'd been the McCarthy hearing. There was a free speech movement, which was in a way a descendant of the Mark McCarthy hearings in Berkeley, which was about usage of an area of grass in front of the campus for distributing literature and stuff, which the regents tried to ban. And then, in the background of all this, I'm just trying to say what the atmosphere was. The assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and then the Democratic Convention, where Eugene McCarthy failed to make an impression. You know? So everybody put their faith in Eugene McCarthy, and it didn't work. So there was this dreadful war. I'll tell you a bit about the war. This is the things that people saw at the time, okay? I can just minimize that. There we are. And then get off to the home. Oh, there it is. Okay, so this is my slide. Like this. Computer. What's it doing? Pardon? You think it's seized up?
Yeah, I suppose it's crazy.
It's doing something. Yeah. Close it.
That's just crazy.
Don't do it.
There we go.
Oh, yeah, I've got it. Okay, view.
Slideshow
down here, slideshow, sorry. Okay.
Slideshow.
There we are. Ah, that's all.
Got an old version.
Yep, next one. So, I'll leave that one out. So this is the bombing. The Americans thought that by bombing the North, they would bring them to heel very quickly. They thought it would just be a walkover, okay? There's the next one.
It's cricket. Cricket.
Oh, yeah.
Click the screen.
I clicked the screen, right. Okay. You can see I'm not That's the one that took me
a long time. No, no.
Okay. See, there's a B-52. That's, I think it's a B-52. Or B-49 somewhere. And here's the effect. What do we do? They attempted to deny food to the insurgent areas by bombing the paddy fields. You know, they did a number of things. It was a fantastic thing that they dropped 8 million tons of bombs, four times the amount of bombs that were dropped in World War II. 9,000 Hamlets were damaged. And they herded the people in these, what they called insurgent areas, into protected villages. And anybody outside was Viet Cong. And they had these free fire zones, you know, where they'd go along the river with in boats, and they would just machine gun the bushes. And if somebody was hit, they said, oh, we've got a Viet Cong. You know. So it was quite a, you know, brutal thing. So this is the enlarged, these craters. You see, they're enormous things, 40 yards across. This is the spray. They decided, they sent the soldiers into the jungle where they couldn't see their enemies. And the man at the front, you know, when he was shot, they know that they'd come into contact with the enemy. And they decided to remove the jungle. So they dropped, they sprayed 11 million gallons of Agent Orange. I just got these things out of the book. It was 40 years ago, it's a long time. I had to do quite a lot of research to find out what was going on. Agent Orange was a herbicide, okay? They destroyed 25 million acres of farmland. 12 million acres of forest, you know. Just amazing, you know. 2 million Vietnamese deaths, that's what they estimated in this book over. And 50,000 Americans died. So it's a little bit larger than the wars we are in now, you know. And about 15 million refugees. And it says that 9.2 million Americans went through. They served for a year at a time. So it was a fantastic thing. And these are the things that we, these are pictures that I've been showing you, are pictures from the local newspaper. They've been lying in my drawer for 40 years, and I've scanned them in. So this is the sort of thing that the students were seeing at the time, okay? Just to lay the scene that the student was in. So the scene was St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Post was a good paper and published lots of things. Mylae massacre. They went around the country. This, I think, was only one incident. I think there were others, you know. People say there were others. Where they moved in and they shot everybody in the village. And they arrested, these photographs were shown around for about a year in one of the towns, I think, in Minneapolis or somewhere like that, by the chap who had them. And it was only when John Hersey got hold of them and publicised them that they got published nationwide. But again, the students were seeing this stuff. And Callie was tried and sentenced, and I think he served a month in jail, or no jail at all. Nobody was convicted of a crime for this. It's the same one again, sorry. Yeah. Okay, so... Great. Yes, this was one of the demonstrations. We went across to Washington, where a million people gathered for the moratorium against the war. They were trying to stop things. And I had a friend who was in economics, and so he knew that he was part of the whole thing. So I got invited along. We crossed 8 states overnight, 24 hours, you know, and ended up here at 6 o'clock in the morning. And you've seen this on the film Forrest Gump. Okay? That's the same thing again.
I think you've got the wrong version.
No, I've got the wrong one. Sorry.
Well, if you go back to this version, show.
Pardon? This is okay. I'll manage it. This is. When we were standing there on the green, this little procession passed us. Well, quite a big procession. And it was led by people dressed in American uniform, American Revolutionary uniform. So we joined them. And it was a very theatrical kind of thing. So, dramatizing everything that was happening. And you can see the banners in the back there. And these are the police. And they marched up to the doors of the Department of Justice, and they were banging on the door.
There we go.
They were shouting, "Free Bobby Seale, Free Bobby Seale." So the black movement and the anti-war movement intersected, okay? You can see them dressed in their costumes. And then this was the Kent State, a small university in Ohio, State University. And the thing that people, I didn't know. I've been looking up this stuff in the last few weeks and found out a lot of things that I didn't know. That the day before this happened, the Reserve Officer Training Building had been burned down. That's why the National Guard were on the campus. Okay. And, you know, this is reminiscent of China, isn't it? This young lad waving his flag, and there are the soldiers pointing their guns at the students. I'm just trying to... Oh, God, this is the wrong thing.
But you're about to look when you want to.
You think so? Here we are. This is the soldiers. There's the general telling them to stop. Then he fired for a few minutes. Yes. There's the girl. You know, she was a teenage runaway, and that was her boyfriend. Famous photographs, but these were in the newspaper at the time in St. Louis. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that stimulated the students to do what they did. Okay. There's a student demonstrating with the National Guardsmen after the event. Here we are. So this was a demonstration on the campus of St. Louis, in St. Louis, okay, where I was. Before this, the Reserve Officer Training Building had mysteriously burned down over the night. So there was a grand jury sitting investigating the campus. A grand jury is like they decide whether any crimes have been committed, you know, local citizens. And there was an injunction against any demonstrations on the campus. So, you know, these kids were very brave. They were confronting the police, you know, who were armed, you know. and they were disobeying a federal injunction. So the campaign that I saw anyway was, let me get onto that now, okay? Here we are. So there were meetings, you know. So there were meetings that I went to, because I knew these people in social sciences, who were sort of graduate students in social science. It seemed to be the local leaders, really. And they were discussing what to do, you know. So there were all these sort of discussions. And they set up a thing called the Washington University Liberation Front. You know, we were very young. And Wolf, it was called. Anyway, so I remember, and all sorts of things happened. All the divisions, all the splits between the anarchists, the hippies, the politicos, it all happened there, you know. All exactly the same as everything you've seen, you know. So I remember at one of these meetings there was a discussion about the, you know, the way forward and the progress of the war and the fate of American capitalism. This young lad got up and said, "You're talking, there's too much talk, you know, we've got to do something." And he let out a yell and he jumped out the window, you know. And it was a grand fool, of course.
You weren't doing acid as well.
He might have been. And then, you know, there was mass meetings, you know, where, and demonstrations. And of course, by this time, there was an injunction against demonstrations on the campus. So, you know, a lot of creativity came out. The women, there were lots of mothers, graduate students with children, I had a wife and a child. They went to the site where demonstrations were banned, you know, and there was a parade going on, the training session on the parade ground, and they marched in with their prams, and they were inspecting the site to see whether it was suitable for setting up a creche. And of course the colonel was hopping mad and didn't know what to do with it, you know, so they did that, you know. And then one day, there was a demonstration at night, and massive people, and they marched forward, and they boarded up the windows. This building was condemned, you know. This was the remaining building, the one that hadn't been burned down. And there were teach-ins, you know. I remember a very large meeting where some of the black students got up and said, "Well, you're all, you know, you're all white, privileged kids, you know. What you should do to help us is go home and cut your parents' throats, you know." And it took a bit of calming down, you know. And in contrast to that, there was a sort of Black Panther branch in St. Louis, led by a guy, a bit like Thumba Balogun, you know, a young man. And the police kept stopping him and harassing him for parking things and traffic offences and breaking his rights and getting him for having no rights and things like that. He ended up on, I saw him on television. I mean, I was beavering away in the lab during the day, you know, going to these meetings in the evening. So I saw him on the television with both his arms broken. He was in Cairo, or Cairo, let's call it, Illinois. He'd been run out of town. And a message came up to the student union that the guy who was an older man, who was also the leader of this thing, wanted the students to come down and help them, because all the youths had been arrested, 17 of them or something like 17 of them had been arrested. They were in the police station and they were holding a demonstration in front of the police station, can you imagine? And they wanted the white students to come down, because obviously they thought the police didn't shoot the white students. So, because the police shot people in St. Louis all the time, you know, they were entitled to shoot people. They tried to make a law that they couldn't shoot somebody unless their lives were in danger or somebody else's life was in danger, which was the law in California. And they said, no, we decide when to shoot people. And another thing that happened, just to tell you how violent the place was, I'm rambling a bit, but there was an incident of burglary in the local suburb, which was separate from the main city. And the policeman got shot and fired at somebody who fired back. And so they wanted dum-dum bullets. It was in the local paper. And the journalist, it was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which was a sort of liberal paper, said, well, that's against the Geneva Convention. The guy said, well, the police downtown have always had them, and we want them now. So it's a really violent sort of situation. And these kids were facing those sort of police, you know. Anyway, so we went down to the police station. I went with them and gathered in front of the police station. And there was this little black man standing between these huge black policemen. And he was talking about the pigs. How are we going to get these pigs? And the pigs aren't going to succeed. And these bloody policemen looking down at him. I thought, oh my God, fantastic, you know. So these things all cut across each other. And, sorry, am I going on too long? No, right, okay. So I just wanted to give you an idea of what it was like there. There were these massive student meetings. There was also a huge staff meeting which I went to, because, you know, they were concerned about what was going on. There'd been an occupation and all this sort of thing, and they were concerned about things, and there was a big discussion. And it was fairly typical, you know, people got up and said, well, the students, they're just here for 3 years, and we're here for the whole time, you know, our 3 years. Our job is to teach them. They're into politics. They're anarchists. They're Bolsheviks. They're all in it for a kick, you know. They want power, you know. And other people say, well, we've been working on this ROTC thing for many years now. They've ruined it for us by making all this trouble. One of the professors of physics, the only one really, I seem to remember it, an older, he was a full professor, he got up and he said, actually, the students are concerned about the war. And he made a speech about that, you know. But generally, it was that stuff, you know. So, and just as an aside, when I got back to York, the students were blockading one of the exams in York University in England. And they were dissatisfied with something that had been going on for many years. It was something to do with the social science course, and it wasn't being taught as an integrated course. It was being taught, you know, by all, but they thought it wasn't for them, you know. So they blockaded the exam. And the same things were said. Who were they said by? They were said by Peter Sedgwick, you know, what's their name now? Bob Luther, all the grey eminences of the Socialist Workers' Party. They were saying exactly the same things as I heard said in St. Louis, you know. The students were bums, we know about politics, what do they know, all that sort of thing. That disgusted me. A number of other things. There was a student who, there was a ban on any demonstrations on the campus, you see. So, and he went up into the library, which was called the Olin Library, which was built by Olin Matheson, which was one of the tanks. They made tanks and guns, and it was in St. Louis, one of the biggest manufacturers of that. And the university was supported by these sort of people. It was supposed to be the Harvard of the Midwest. They set it up so they would have a managerial, you know, class in the turn of the century. And so he still red paint underneath the picture of Olin in the hallway of the, in the corridor of the library, you see, as a symbol, you know. And he was arrested, and he went to court. He refused to speak to the magistrate and hung a picture of a Vietnamese woman around his neck, and refused to say anything. So they sent him into a mental institution, filled him up with tranquilizers, and his father had to come and get him out, you know. They couldn't understand his stand, you know. It was a complete lack of understanding. What else have I got? Finally, how am I doing? There we go. There we are. I'm going to go to the previous one then. Here we are. So one night, there was a huge demonstration, a huge gathering in the main quadrangle of the university. It was built like a sort of replica of a Cambridge campus, you know, in stone and all that. Anyway, they marched over to the ROTC building, and it was burned down publicly. About 2,000 people gathered around, and the whole thing was burned down. And here we are. There's the paint. There was another demonstration where paint was thrown, red paint was thrown at the thing. And you should be able to see the boards. No, it's on here, but not on there. Can we just move this slide here? There we are. There are the boards, are boarding up the building.
Okay. This is them actually burning it down.
This is the building being burned down here. And because I've got the wrong. These are things that were going on in other places, okay? This was Cornell. The black part of the black thing, the Black Panthers, they went around saying, well, the white men are all carrying guns. You know, you've got a right to carry a gun. We'll carry guns, you know. And this was an incident where, this is where the racial thing intersected, you know. This was an incident where the students had occupied a building and they were threatened. There were supposed to be some white students coming with guns to get them out, you know. So they got guns and this was them coming out. A really shocking scene on a university campus, you know. The thing was just out of this world, you know. This is at Yale. So this was another meeting. And this is Fred Hampton. That's Fred Hampton, who was a Black Panther, who was shot. And he was addressing the crowd at Yale. Nixon assailed violence. This was the civilian post dispatch. which you can't see, I'm afraid, it's further up, was something that was going on at the same time. And it was in the same part of the newspaper. This was a union dispute where somebody had been shot. You know, a union leader had been shot. An inter-union dispute. Yeah, that's all the time I've got. So, what am I trying to say? I think that you know, the students fit into any plans, but you've got to include the idea that a large part of the workforce is going to be into university. These people, there's not room for them in the upper reaches of management. So you can't discount them. And it's possible for them to become radicalized. It is possible. That's it.
Cheers.
Well, I don't know if you want to do any questions now, even if it's at the end.
Whatever you like.
Yes, please.
I do apologise. I did answer a call of nature just now, yeah?
Pardon?
I did answer a call of nature just now, yeah? I'm intrigued. Obviously, at that time, it was called the Great Society.
Yes.
Now we've got the Big Society.
Yeah.
At that time, we had the arms economy.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of the workers were involved, like, the defence industry.
Yeah.
Or the war industry, we could have caught, yeah, rather than that.
Yeah.
Was it the AFL, CIO, the big trade union?
Yes, yes.
What linkage was there between trade union leaders supporting the students, or were there none at all?
Well, look, I don't know about the thing in general. I only know what my experience was.
Yeah.
As far as I was concerned, the students were on their own. There was no response from union or working class people in St. Louis. You felt that they were really, somewhere else. There was huge industries. There was McDonnell Douglas, where they made the F-15, which I think now is Boeing. There was Olin Matheson, which made tanks and guns. There was Dow Chemical, which made Avant Orange. These were big industries in the city. There was a huge food combine, which just recently, or a year or two ago, tried to take over the world agriculture. Ralston Purina. They tried to patent genetically engineered wheat and take over. Because if you didn't buy their seeds, you couldn't farm, you know. But, and they gave that up. So these industries were in St. Louis. And as far as I know, there was no connection. I think that was the problem with the student rebellion. It just wasn't linked. It was just a rebellion, it wasn't a revolution.
Yes, that's what they did say, the rebellion, the nuclear revolution. They were left swinging in the wind, basically, weren't they? Yeah, the students on their own.
Really?
Yeah.
But there were millions of them. Now,
there seems to have a link to the back campus, don't
they? I think so. You know, now, can I go back to my...
They weren't
briefly to my first ticket. Sorry. Do you mind? Let me just go back to that briefly. Sorry. let me just show you. This is the N show. Oh, it's that. Oh, N is my show. Yeah. N show. This picture I got from Howard Zinn, which will take a couple of minutes to do, I'm sorry. Here we are. So, actually, what I just found this the other day. What this picture is places where buildings were burned down or firebombed. Isn't that incredible? I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea about it. See, this is, New Haven, Connecticut, New York, a pipe bomb explosion, Chicago, Evansville, Illinois, a firebomb, Joint Services Recruiting Station. This is where we were, St. Louis. An incendiary device was logged into the RFC building. Fire resulting from a firebomb destroyed 50% of the building. It was all, this campaign against the military recruitment. Salt Lake City, right out in the sticks, and then a bomb detonated at the entrance of the supply building. See? California. A Molotov cocktail exploded in the RFC building. That's quite astonishing, isn't it? It was very widespread.
Now, you were in St. Louis from 1967 to 1970, yeah?
The ROTC building was burnt down in 1968.
No, 1970.
1970, okay. Yeah.
69-70.
The war went on for about...
5 years, yeah.
For 5 years. Were you in contact with people in Sydney after you left?
No.
Did they do after they built the building?
They built...
What did they do after they built the building?
I don't know. They built, my time came up. They built, I was back in England. They built another, I saw this on the web now. They built another building, which itself was attacked, off the campus.
If the movement of the students organised themselves to destroy this building in 1970, what did they do for the next 5 years?
I'm not certain.
No, I seem to remember that during my childhood, we used to get Vietnam on the telly all the time when you were having your tea and everything.
That's right.
You know, death and destruction and everything. Some of the things that I remember from then were other acts of disobedience by people, like mass burnings of draft cards.
Yes.
Quite a lot of people were going into exile in places like Sweden. Did you have any experience of that?
Lots of people went to Canada.
Huge numbers.
One of the things that Baptist is that I was deeping away into that during the day.
I had
my future. You had to get something out, you had to work and you weren't moving to the night. But I also took part in this stuff.
So I think in the discussion, to think that the IFL-CII was immediately going to be broken away from organised labours to immediately be broken away from the political establishment. It's rising. It's expected. That's going to be almost towards the end of the process, I think, of radicalisation of the American working class. And they had it really, really tightly sewn up, so much so that the AFL-CIO was exporting their model of anti-communist trade union to other labour movements around the world. I think what was interesting...
In South Vietnam.
They had other... there were initiatives that were set up, you had an audience there watching Fred Hampton from the Black Panthers. But it seemed difficult, but it looked like it was white, it was black, it was... So I think it's a real demonstration that there were some concrete links between these radicalised movements. And the political fallout was they held conventions to try and develop a third force in American politics. It didn't actually come to fruition, but it seemed to be for a certain amount of time, I think, around the early 70s, that there would be a break in the dominance of the Republican Democrats. And that what I feel to that was the idea that there were attempts to bring the anti-war movement into Democratic politics, but it was beaten back literally.
Eugene McCarthy.
Yeah. This was which you were referring to. So I think there were real attempts to develop meetings that was trying to bring these movements together into a political force. I think that really shook the American establishment. They had had it hitherto completely sewn up as Republican Democrat. It was almost the same, but there were initiatives in that direction. It didn't come to anything because there were some, and I'm not certain why that was. It could have just been some feeling between the individuals in the movement, or whether they lacked an overarching ideology that could tie those together, because socialism was seen to be
un-American.
Exactly, which was difficult to make an advance there. And even groups like the Black Panther bringing together things like, they sold Nazis on Red Club. Right. I don't think they're really, they're still working towards something beyond a kind of cultural nationalist perspective.
Well, that's my point. One last question, one last statement, that's it, I'll let it go. I don't think at that time, potential was enormous, but the connections didn't happen today.
I'm not going to say too much, but I think it depends what you mean by connections. I'd say the New Left, right, and the Black Radicals that came out after the mid-60s civil rights stuff, like the Panthers, United Slaves, or lots and lots of organisations, and the anti-war movement, and quite a lot of other struggles did come together at this moment around sort of 1970-71. Now, the question you're talking about is organised labour, and how involved that was. Well, I think that we've got a meeting at the end of where's Kieran?
Oh, yeah.
On the Black League of Black Revolutionary Workers in Detroit. Now, I mean, would you say, Kieran, that there was some connection between those movements and what happened in Detroit?
There was a start of connections. The AFL-CIO was around, and yeah, it still is a problem. It would always be a business union. It wasn't in the business of making trouble for capitalism, it was a business of making trouble against Vietnam, nothing like that. So, radical workers, black and blue, lots of stuff to go in factories and Detroit and stuff like that, which is what we're just talking about. We'll see in the film, I think. But there was no chance for a massive connection at that point between the unions and the anti-Vietnam movement, student-based anti-Vietnam movement. There was a chance when it became the draft and became working class people that was getting drafted, there was a chance there, but it never sort of happened totally. But there's a mass-based thing, no, there's no connection, and it was a waste of opportunity.
Right, I'm going to hack on now.